Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is August 22nd, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, our theme is gearing up for the fall firewalk. As I said in the last several Solari reports, the decision coming out of the Bohemian Grove has been to lower the boom. That means the leadership is running a process where the legacy systems are going to have their liabilities renegotiated without allowing the facts of how we got to where we are emerge, or they're going to certainly do their best. So, for example, we're bailing out the banks with $27 trillion of what I would consider to be gifts. But, of course, we must bring financial accountability to retirees. And we're going through a process. We push things off. Now we're lowering the boom, and we're coming into the fall when a lot of decisions have to be made. And that's why I call it fall firewalking, because the beatdown is upon us, and there's going to be propaganda of the first order that there is now. So, and another reason I call it firewalking is for investors, it means you just got to walk through the process, and there's one hot spot after another. And what makes it worse is all the anger and frustration means that there's lots of scare talk. Let's look at a couple of the things that we're going to work through, and we're going to have to work them through when the cover stories of corruption and incompetence are wearing thin. It's all beginning to look like a plan, because it is. But that doesn't mean the day-to-day details are a plan whatsoever. Fiscal policy, we're coming into the U.S. debt limit. It's going to have to be raised. And, of course, we have the budget squabbles, no expectation of a bipartisan agreement, and I think we're going to fall back on the sequestration. So another round of automatic cuts. Then monetary policy, big question. Will the Fed start to taper in September? It's got lots of people on eggshells. And then, of course, we have the German elections and the choice of a new Fed chairman to be announced before the end of the year. So there's lots of decisions that need to be made. There are a lot of different political constituencies all needing every penny in that process. And so there's going to have to be losers in it. And that means the fighting for revenues gets stronger and stronger. One person likened it to, he says, so I get it. It's like the grocery stores. They're all putting out stale bread and raising the prices. It's a little bit of that feeling to it. Every federal and state and local agency has overhead, and increasingly what you're seeing is ridiculous stories and excuses to try and come up with more ways to claw in revenues to cover overhead. In the meantime, as I said last week, the thing to watch is not the equity markets or the price of gold, it's interest rates. Will interest rates stay in the channel or head higher? We're seeing lots of money continually drawn back from the emerging markets. It's like bringing the blood back into the heart and the lungs, away from the periphery of empire, as the sort of central headquarters needs the blood. So keep an eye on the 10 and 30 year treasury bond, because that's going to tell us a lot. Now, integrated into the price of the 10 or 30 year treasury is the ultimate ability of the U.S. to make good on its debts by printing currency that has because the currency has value to the people who get a hold of it, or because it has the ability to force people to take and circulate it. And that's why the interview with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson this week is such an important one. The weak underbelly of the U.S. system is quality control. We've had a financial mechanism for many years that can continually, through force, literally harvest the whole planet. And when you have a system like that, it's quite extraordinary financial mechanism, but you have no way of using financial accountability to rebalance the system and to bring it back into some kind of rational optimization. You know, you just keep using force to get more money, and you've literally seen a federal budget that's gone out of control. So, The difficulty of this, of course, is if you have no quality control year after year after year, you continue to depend on the U.S. military performing. And the problem is, how do you create and operate an effective, high-quality, high-performance military within a system that operates this way? And it's one of the things I talked with Colonel Wilkerson about, because the greater the dependency on the U.S. military becomes, the more intense the pressure is in Washington to bring the leadership up according to political criteria as opposed to anything related to performance metrics. Anyway, more on that when we get to the interview. Money and markets, as I said last week, Fukushima continues to be an extremely important story. It's very hard to know the truth. And I think part of it is you have the equivalent of a nuclear meltdown, and no one knows how to contain it. And so we're looking at a tremendously challenging situation, and I continue to look for information. If you get any sources that you think are reliable, please continue to send them this way. We're having as I said before, when you go through a period like the full firewalking, what happens is different constituent groups are politicking for their point of view, and they're putting forward solutions for what they need or solutions for what their system needs. And because of the intense competition in a milieu of the one we have, you get just an outpouring of ideas which are clueless, deceptive, perverse, sleazy. I could go on and on. And one of the things I want to do with the Solera Report is to help you build immunity to bad ideas. So I want to go over some of the more clever ones and the more dangerous ones this week, and just give you a little thought on what's really going on here. An editorial from Knight Kiplinger, who in fact is somebody I have great respect for, proposing that we mandate 401ks for everyone in the United States. This is a way for making the broad population save enough money to finance the Treasury and cycle more money into the Treasury just when the Treasury has to cycle more money out to our Social Security and Medicare. If you look at countries that are very financially sound in their organization and management, so if you take a look at Chile with its nationally mandated pension fund and balanced budget and rainy day fund, you're looking at a country that makes a lot of sense financially. So the idea of everybody having a 401k and being mandated to save, in one sense, you can say a lot of, oh, well, that makes sense. Well, let's look at things. We had a national pension fund. It was called Social Security. It's been money. Basically, the money's been stolen. It hasn't been properly managed. We also had IRAs. They were pumped and dumped over the last decade. So I think we're looking at a system before we mandate more of the same. There needs to be a real conversation about, well, where did the money that was stolen out of the last systems go to? I should have also mentioned the money sort of skimmed out the back door in the pension funds. Where's the money stolen gone? And there's no point in putting more money in until you have integrity. And I think there are real issues at this point of integrity at the system, not to mention the leadership attacking a lot of state and local pension funds that do have integrity and using the sort of demand for integrity to, if anything, destroy their integrity. So one question is, how can we have another mandated system when all the other mandated or influenced systems have not had the integrity that we need them to do? That's number one. Number two, one of the reasons people don't save enough is because they have no income. Or they don't have enough income to cover their expenses and taxes. So that's very simple. You just lower taxes. And so I think lowering taxes and reducing the stress of government on the population would help immensely, particularly those things we do in the financial capital system and in the regulatory system that basically forces small businesses and small farms out of business. And then finally, as we've seen with Obamacare, you can mandate something, but you can't get blood from a stone. And we're seeing a significant increase in unemployment and moving people from full-time jobs to part-time jobs or doing a variety of other things that cancel benefits so business can get out of the healthcare mandates. So mandating more of a burden on small business is going to be is going to backfire in ways which I expect Obamacare will backfire. So I think it's a very good idea to get money back that was stolen, and I think it's a very good idea to ensure integrity. But people sense this, and I think, you know, they see ideas coming, and they don't see this as a productive comment. They see this as just more intervention and theft. I put up a commentary this week on the blog called The Worst Idea Going, and this really is the worst of the week. It's an idea we've seen come back again and again. It's a little bit like the gopher in Caddyshack. If you ever saw that movie, it just keeps popping up. And each time it pops up with different constituencies or a different face because they keep trying to sell it. And they keep trying to sell it looking as though it's an idea that's coming bottom up. It's not. It's coming top down. And the idea is that every person deserves a certain income. It's a human right. And essentially what this will, the way this will play out is everybody gets a check from the state. Now, as I described in the commentary, if we are going into communities and doing things which destroy the economy, and then as we make money destroying the local economy, take a small portion of that and cycle it back as stipends to the people in that community, they go from people who are in command and have power within the economic process to people who are totally dependent on the state. It means they're very easy to control. So, dreadful idea. It's kind of addressing the symptom instead of the problem and making the overall problem worse. And it truly does lead to a totalitarian state. So take a look at that if you're interested. The worst idea going. Finally, Obama, the president, proposes tying federal financial aid to colleges and universities according to school standing, which means essentially all the money will go to the rich. It means Harvard gets everything. I'm exaggerating to make a point, but it's a way of marketing. How can I say this? What's the right word? It's the way of taxing the average American and then taking the money and shipping it to help finance the children of the rich. On top of everything else that's going on in education, it's another one of these outrageously bad ideas, and is one of the reasons I come back to the movie They Live is a perfect example of what's going on. Okay, let's turn to the surveillance society, because one of the common themes and much of the news over the last several weeks and continuing this week is the ongoing debate about invasive involvement of government and corporations in our digital communications and the compromise of privacy. We have an article saying, oh, the NSA was scanning 75% of phone calls. Like, that's some big revelation. It's inconceivable to me that they're not scanning and reporting 100% of phone conversations. A story from Common Dreams, let me read it. It's up on the blog. Amid ongoing controversy over NSA warrantless spying programs, another legal battle exposes the Obama administration's willingness to steamroll civil liberties in the name of security. Last week, the Obama administration urged the U.S. Supreme Court to issue a precedent-setting ruling that the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable and warrantless searches and seizures, somehow allows for warrantless searches of personal cell phones, the Washington Post reports. Okay, well, this has been going on for a long time. And as one subscriber said this week, well, if they've been doing this all along, why do they care to make it legal now? Well, the challenge is if you're in an environment in Washington where you have very, very even violent competition over various political decisions and appointments, you can certainly understand why the people being asked to implement these policies would prefer for them to be lawful, because otherwise, if they're technically against the law, then it's very easy for their competition to play games with them, criminal investigations, etc. So it creates great insecurity if everybody's being called on to implement illegal policies, particularly if the American people are now cognizant that they're illegal. Anyway, what's come out in this with different discussions of people who are great allies or subscribers over the last week is hearing more and more people not able to fathom the operational capacity exists to scan and digest all the digital communications of 300 plus million people. And I assure you that it does. Let me read an email I wrote to one person, one skeptic this week. They can absolutely scan and digest the emails and phone conversations of 300 million people. They've been working since the 1980s to build this using keywords, clusters, neural networks, patterns. The computation power allows them to build data on each of 300 million people and relate that to the marketing and emailing they are those people are receiving online, including subliminal messages. This is growing very advanced. They have the transaction and financial flows in every place tracked and patterned. Think of an entire digital infrastructure that parallels the real world. They can map and aggregate global conversations for insight into the psychic storm. They can collect it, they can process it, they can use it to feedback in short periods at the individual and household level, they can use it to trade. So the piece do they piece out early adapters in places and sectors? For sure. So they do not listen to everyone equally. Watch The Truman Show. It's not just a movie. Watch The Listening. Watch Enemy of the State. And these are based on more than a decade ago. And as I said, our problem is not NSA. It's AT&T, IBM. Worth rereading. And then I point to my article, The Data Beast. This is the primary machine at the heart of managing the slow burn, because they can listen and respond at the individual level to 300 million people. The cell phone tower system is first and foremost a mind control system. I strongly recommend that you educate yourself about this again and again. The reason you think the market will assert itself and I don't is because the litigation permitted me a personal and intimate education on how the surveillance machine works and feeds back into the financial and economic control system. I know you cannot fathom that this exists, but it does. Anyway, so I want you to, it really pays to understand where the technology is and how it applies to you. And I do want to point you back to several Saleri reports. If you haven't listened to the one on Adam Trombley and I do talk about entrainment technology, I think this is critical because, again, you know, your message, your emails and your phones can be scanned by artificial intelligence, and literally the machine can trigger different entrainment and subliminal programming that will then affect what you buy, how you behave, what you think. If you understand that this machinery exists, then you can protect yourself from it. So take a look or listen to the Adam Trombley interview on entrainment technology. Catherine Albrecht has been on the Saleri Report twice talking about spy chips and privacy issues. And then some great movies, The Listening and Enemy of the State, if you haven't seen them. Very entertaining, very interesting. I always said if Enemy of the State was my training movie. Interestingly enough, this summer, an article was posted talking about Enemy of the State, which was a movie that Gene Hackman and Will Smith starred in. It came out in 1998, made by British director Tony Scott, one of my favorite directors. And it portrayed the NSA as a rogue agency who kills various people, including a United States senator, in the process of trying to get something equivalent to the Patriot Act. Let me just quote the article. Former NSA Director General Michael Hayden was promoted to head the agency as the movie came out and was deeply worried about the public perception it created. James Risen reported in his 2006 book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. Hayden, who went on to become the director of the CIA under President George W. Bush, was appalled by the NSA's portrayal and responded with a full-fledged PR campaign. The agency's very existence was long a state secret. Okay, so interestingly enough, Tony Scott, who was the director of Enemy of the State, was either jumped or thrown off a bridge out in California on August 2012. Completely inexplicable death. No one understands how it could have happened. And given what's now happening with surveillance, big questions. Now, on the good news side of the story, the U.S. cloud companies have emerged as defending the role of freedom and trying to get different provisions of the Patriot Act rolled back. Predictions out of Washington that some of them will be rolled back this year, more rolled back in 2015 when the Patriot Act comes up for renewal. And that's because it's very bad for business. U.S. cloud companies are now losing business in Europe, losing business globally. Nobody wants to be in a U.S. cloud company because they don't want the NSA having access to all their stuff. So this is coming down to money starting to line up on the side of privacy, which is a good thing. we see as part of this the marginalization of many of the people trying to do something about what's going on. This week we see Bradley Manning, who was sentenced to 35 years, announced that he wants to become a woman, that he's transsexual. We have the a brouhaha about Glenn Greenwald's partner, Brazilian fellow, being held up at the airport in London. And of course, the story goes from what Greenwald's saying about the substance to, you know, Greenwald and his relationship with his partner and his partner being detained. And then finally, Michael Hastings, who it's inconceivable to me was he died in a car accident. It's inconceivable to me that it was an accident. It looked like an assassination to me. But the coroner in California coming out and saying that Hastings had drugs in his or presence of drugs in the autopsy. So we have a complete marginalization. The story is turned into a tangent of Manning being a transsexual, Hastings being on drugs, and Greenwald, you know, his personal life as opposed to the real substance of the story. It's a perfect example of how the major media is used to turn things. And that and that shows you the strength of the fear on these issues and the extent to which they're trying to marginalize anybody who does anything about them. But the surveillance issue is going to continue to be discussed for quite some time, because there's more and more money on the side of privacy, and the nature of the surveillance is used so extensively for economic warfare that you're going to have money on both sides of this issue, and that money's going to grow in terms of the money that's getting hurt in the economy by this kind of surveillance. Okay, another theme I want to talk to, and again, I put a commentary up on the blog, and it's about U.S. slave labor, and it relates to a discussion that's happening and changes in prison policy. Let me go back to the end of World War II. Two sort of pools of knowledge came back into the United States at the end of World War II. The first thing that happened was we recruited a significant number of Nazi leaders, particularly scientists and intelligence operatives. They were recruited to come to the United States, or they were integrated into the intelligence networks, and they were integrated into universities and businesses. And a great deal of time and money was spent to study the Nazi experience and what we could learn from it. At the same time, the group, particularly in the intelligence agencies and the military, who were in war in the Pacific, learned a great deal about how to use drugs to finance armies and occupations. And those two knowledge pools came together and synthesized into a model which has been operating very extensively and with great impact in the United States since that knowledge was sort of integrated and then put into practice. And that is the idea of using narcotics trafficking as a way of doing a leverage buyout of a place. And a lot of the train tracks for the kind of surveillance and police state that we're talking about was built around bringing narcotics into neighborhoods and then building the war on drugs. It's sort of a, if you ever remember W.C. Fields and his snake and snake oil potion, you know, in one pocket he has the snake and the other he has a snake oil potion that he's selling you to protect you from the snake. And so the war on drugs and the drugs came in together, and it's been remarkable, and I've written a lot about it, so I'm not going to repeat all of that here. You can see my story, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, or Narco Dollars for Beginners. Needless to say, this model has grown and grown and grown, and we've now ended up as the leader throughout the world with a very significant prison population. Now, it's important to understand that that prison population was not built trying to protect anybody from drugs. You know, if you follow the trail back far enough, the same people throwing everybody in prison and making money in the prisons were essentially involved in bringing in the drugs. So you have an intentional plan to do what some people would call economic cleansing and other people would call genocide. It's really a mix of both. And in the 90s, accelerated dramatically under the leadership of, among other people, Eric Holder at the Department of Justice as D.C. U.S. Attorney, and then moving up into the Department of Justice afterwards. You saw policies where literally SWAT teams were dropped into communities, rounding up innocent kids, bringing them into jail under arrest, and then cutting funding to the public defender's office so literally they couldn't get lawyers, or the lawyers were handling so many cases at once, it was the same as not having a lawyer. So we're talking about a policy that I would call, and I believe very fairly so, genocide. Now, as you brought in those young people into prison, they went into prisons where their labor was marketed to the Department of Defense by a for-profit company owned by the Department of Justice. So we're literally looking at what I would describe as the slave labor system. And I don't think there was anything in terms of slave labor that we were doing that Hitler wasn't doing. We were just doing it at a more profitable basis. Now, the interesting thing about understanding that model is if you look at the money, it wasn't just Americans who were going into prison, oftentimes innocent Americans or Americans whose crimes were relatively minor and whose punishment was quite major, but it was also the taxpayers going into prison. If you look at the Dylan Reed story, and I just had Justin make up a slide so you could see a little bit of the numbers, the slide up on the webinar software shows a list of my former partners at Dylan Reed who had financed a prison company in the 90s, and I show the profits they made in a relatively short time financing and flipping the company stock. For example, the chairman of the firm had $750,000 profits. If you look at the number of people who had to go to prison to generate those profits, the stock market at that time was trading on a per bed basis. So think of it as a slavery system where you trade per slave, you get a certain amount of market capitalization for each person in prison. 34 people had to go to prison for a long time to generate the chairman's stock profits. But how many people had to work their entire life to pay the taxes for those 34 people? It was 340 people. If you look at the profits of all the Dylan Reed officers and directors, I estimate that 11,523 people had to work their entire life to generate the profits for those taxpayers, meaning 1,152 people had to go to jail for a pretty long time. So putting innocent or people, minor criminals, in prison for a long time and putting many, many taxpayers in prison. And so what has happened recently is I've seen more and more people start to realize that what is going on in the prison population and these policies is not just corruption. It's not just incompetence. It's not just something that got out of hand. It is a policy, and it is a policy of economic cleansing and genocide, that it is really that. I had a little discussion with Marcin Jakubowski, which I put up on the commentary I wrote on the blog, about how this was so, and referring him to read the Dylan Reed story. I just saw, and that transcript inspired one of the subscribers to email me and say, you've got to see this new documentary, The House I Live In, which is about the war on drugs. I put it up in the trailer up in the blog. It's worth, if you're interested in the war on drugs, it's worth watching. David Simon, the creator of The Wire, which is one of the best series that really unpacks and describes the war on drugs. Marvelous, marvelous, talented director and producer. David Simon described the war on drugs as a Holocaust in slow motion. I think that's, if anything, that's an understated description. Anyway, my bet is that Holder coming out several weeks ago, as he did, and we covered this with the commentary and discussion on the Solari report, now Attorney General Holder coming out and saying we need to roll back mandatory sentences and some of these policies, that's Holder knowing that things have reached the point where too many people are starting to figure this out and starting to ask serious questions. And that puts a lot of different parts of the system in real danger. And so I think Holder is smelling the tea leaves, or certainly Holder is following the lead of being told that too many people are reading the tea leaves and are scared that the American people are going to figure out, you know, that this is not a legitimate system. There's something else going on as well. You have, coming into sequestration, you have automatic cuts, and that means you have serious budget issues. Lockheed Martin needs that money and wants that money for things related to keeping the dollar up. They have a lot more political clout than prison companies. So just as we're seeing with the cloud companies, I think there's a lot of pressure behind the scenes by people who have a lot of political and lobbying clout and can assert their rights to that money ahead of prison companies. We saw the Economist this week, the New Economist, I would say the official organ of the Anglo-American Alliance, come out and say that Holder didn't go far enough. And so I think there's a real effort to backpedal here in a way that reaffirms the legitimacy of the brand and makes sure that many, many people don't finally face what this policy really was about. The new economy growth just keeps booming. So there's lots of good news in the economy. We see MakerBot come out with an announcement that their digitizer will go on sale. What that means is it's getting much easier to convert a physical object into the software plans you need to turn around and move to your 3D printer and start to make a copy of that physical object. So we're just seeing an explosion across the board. I spent last weekend reading a very interesting report from the UK Patent Office on graphene, but it's quite, whether it's 3D printing, whether it's other fabrication technology, whether it's composite materials, whether it's robotics, the explosion of innovation is everywhere. Speaking of explosion of innovation, surprise, surprise, Germany announced that it would recognize Bitcoin, would accept Bitcoin for, I think, tax payments, a couple other payments. That kind of caught me by surprise. That's a very interesting development, particularly if it catches on with other sovereign governments. Finally, we saw NASDAQ close due to a glitch. What's that about? We had a 3-hour shutdown. Lots of stocks couldn't trade. Options shut down. Don't know what it's about. Hard to believe it's just a computer glitch. And it's the kind of thing we see happen when there's a lot of tension in the market about which way the market's going to go. So you always kind of wonder. Okay, well, our hero this week is a remarkable man. He's the former Prime Minister of British Columbia. He was the Premier of British Columbia from 86 to 91. His name is Bill VanderZom, and he has come out with a letter sent to many government officials demanding freedom of information on climate control programs, aka chemtrails, busting open chemtrails and saying, requesting that municipal councils, city councils, and regional boards pass a resolution to say, quote, no particulate matter for climate control be sprayed in the atmosphere above their jurisdiction without informed consent. This is a very courageous act and a very wonderful act. So we tip our hat to the former Premier of British Columbia, Bill VanderZom. I'd like to also mention a runner-up, Greg Palast, who is a wonderful investigative reporter who manages to get people to send him the most amazing documentation, has come up with a little article basically saying Larry Summers shouldn't be Fed chairman, Larry Summers should be in prison, and shows a memo from Tim Geithner to then Deputy Secretary Summers about the WTO financial services negotiations and industry consultations thereon. It's really a little doozy, and these are the kind of documents that Greg Palast gets and makes accessible. And, you know, I just have to say, there's nothing like a great investigative reporter, and he certainly is one. Ask Catherine, one comment from a subscriber, very interesting. Let me get it for you. He says, none of the warmongers have an answer to the question, what happens when suicides exceed combat deaths? It's a good question. One subscriber wrote this week, I'm sure you know of Karen, I think her name is pronounced Hudes, H-U-D-E-S. Do you have any thoughts on her battle to expose the corruption at the World Bank? Does she truly have access to break the bank and cabal? Thanks for your time. In response to, do you have any thoughts on her battle to expose the corruption? I wrote back, no. I reviewed several of her interviews and materials and concluded she was not someone I would recommend to subscribers or invite to interview. And in response, does she truly have the means to break the bank and cabal? I said, no. I got one question for Colonel Wilkerson after I interviewed him. Sorry about that, Brad. And then a question from Jim Gallup, from San Diego. The original bailout we were all sold here in the U.S., the Congress had to approve, was for $700 billion. But you pointed out that the total amount of the bailouts had exceeded $27 trillion, with, I believe, no additional congressional approval for this amount having been necessary. Did the original bailout legislation provide for the people we're really running things to be able to increase the bailouts by unlimited amounts without ever having to face any liability for doing so? They contributed, but it was a combination of many different laws, regulations, and essentially lawlessness. So I would say no, it wasn't sufficient in and of itself. It was a combination of many things. There are so many individuals out there giving us the impression that they're all fighting for our rights and our freedom as individuals, and they have internet audiences who follow them. How do we know who's really legitimate within this area and who's really just covertly working to misguide us on behalf of the powers that be? I would say, by their fruits shall you know them. So first of all, do they understand how things really work? Are they presenting, or are they presenting a fashionable presentation of what is? So I think, you know, you be the judge of that, but I found most people have the ability to judge that. That's number one. Number two, you want to understand how their money works. Who finances them? Are they self-supporting with broadly diversified revenues from just individuals supporting them, or are they getting money from the Ford Foundation? Who's financing them? And then what are their results? And not just what are the results in one situation, but what are the results over many, many, many periods? And I think it's important to also understand that one person can do a piece, but they can't do everything. So, you know, never criticize somebody because they contributed strongly on one issue and did nothing on the other. They can't do everything, especially given the fact that we're not willing to supply them with trillions of dollars or billions of dollars of revenue. So everybody has to work within the budget that can, you know, that can practically support them. Finally, do they provide sufficient information for you to make up your mind for yourself? So what I always try and do is, you know, I'm happy to give you my opinion. That's what I do on the Solari Report. But I try and make sure you get links and documentation and other things up on the blog so that you're free to go make your mind up for yourself. And I think we each have to take responsibility for what we know and believe. And then finally, I would say, who are their allies? Who recommends them? I find that the really excellent people over time prove themselves out with many people, and you can tell a lot by the, you know, by the slow and steady support and networking with lots of other people who are trustworthy. And as I said, everybody can only do a piece, so everybody does their piece. Nobody's perfect, and we each have to be responsible ultimately for what we believe and what we support. But I do think if you follow those methods, you'll get a pretty good sense. And I'm always happy, you know, on the Solari Report, if you have a question about an individual person, I'm happy to try and give you my opinion. Interview. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. The interview's posted up on the blog. I can't recommend it enough. It's a very wide-ranging interview. I asked Colonel Wilkerson to sit in the position of the Joint Chiefs and say, what are the most important issues facing the U.S. military? I had emailed him on this topic about 6 months ago and gave him my list of what I guess the issues were. And interestingly enough, he came back with a somewhat different list, and he included the suicide and sex abuse. I hadn't. It's one I want to talk about in the Let's Go to the Movies section. And what you'll see, what I think emerged from the conversation, is that the biggest challenge is what I talked about at the beginning of tonight's Salieri Report. How in the world do you build a strong military leadership in a world where the governmental structure and the financial system are increasingly corrupt and politicized? How do you build strong morale? How do you build discipline? How do you bring up the chain of command, leaders who are excellent at performing in their military positions? A big one I saw when the little I've worked with the military is, how in the world can you organize your investment of time and resources in things that optimize military performance as opposed to optimize profits for defense contractors? That's a real big one. And right now, we do not have a governance process which holds the investment through the budget accountable to performance. The pull of different constituencies for that money is great, and the dependency of the stock market and the bond market and the derivative markets is dependent. And on one side, you have the short-term interests of, say, a defense contractor's trade a certain way, or you need this kind of money to keep this part of the bond market up. On the other hand, you know, if the military doesn't perform excellently, I assure you the whole house of cards can come down. So there are tremendous tensions playing out through the budget as we go into this and the rounds of budget in 2014 and 2015. And at the heart, in the center of that war is what's going to happen and what's the quality of U.S. military leadership. And I assure you that is germane to the value of your CDs, the value of the dollar bills you hold in your pocket, the value, you know, of many of your financial assets. We can like that or not, but that's the reality. So I really encourage you to listen. Okay, let's go to the movies. The movie I chose was The Invisible War. It's a 2012 documentary about sex abuse in the U.S. military. It's reasonably good in terms of describing the men and women who've experienced that abuse. And it's not just the sexual abuse itself. It's then the abuse dealing with the military justice and healthcare systems. The Invisible War focuses more on the victim. And it doesn't take us into a full look of why this is happening and what can be done. I think it's a much more complex problem than is described. That's quite a serious topic and a long one for a documentary to take on. So I do think it's not a full picture of the whole story. But it does bring up a very important question, and that is for many, right now, the U.S. military is one of the most respected institutions in America today, and the American people have long been the lifeblood of the U.S. military, supplying, obviously, soldiers and all sorts of support in a variety of ways in terms of personnel, and I hadn't really understood the importance of the I'd understood the importance of suicides, but not of the sexual abuse. And one of our producers, when Colonel Wilkerson put it on the list, said to me, "No, this is very, very serious." She said, because the feedback that is coming from people who are coming back from the military and coming back into their families is, there's great anger and sense of betrayal. And this has the ability to really destroy the support of the population for the military, particularly in areas that have traditionally supplied a very high percentage. I live in the Southeast, and the Southeast has always provided a great number of personnel to the U.S. military. And so I hadn't realized the seriousness of what is happening. And it was our producer and Colonel Wilkerson who suggested I take a deeper look. So I think there is a serious problem, and we've seen a lot of announcements by the military over the last 4 to 6 weeks as they struggle with this. And it's a very interesting part of the conversation. But anyway, lively interview. I can't recommend it enough. Okay, that's it for closing. We have John Rappaport, a very interesting interview coming up next week, August 29th. And then September 5th, I'm going to be talking about what is breakthrough energy with Joel Garbon, who's the president of the New Energy Movement, and Jeroen van Straten, who was the very talented entrepreneur from Holland, from Amsterdam, who organized the Global Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference in Holland, and it's doing the same for the one in Boulder this year. And so we wanted to have that in anticipation of the conference in the second week of October in Colorado. Then September 12th with Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. So until I'm with you for September 5th for What is Breakthrough Energy, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. There certainly is one that's throwing us off the telephone. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.